you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
When a competent observer looks for signs of despotism in a community, he looks beyond fine words and noble phrases.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married and make children. That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
Go into the automobile business and compete with the auto truck. Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores? Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise.
Because it's just a big money-making machine. They're wandering through a maze of inauthentic, fake landscapes, and they can't escape.
The message in all this is that the capitalist system in America is unfair and is, in fact, a failure at providing for basic human needs or maintaining continued national growth.
I can't wait for, like, the episode of, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants, like, team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
Bottom-up horizontal connection is sharing at all levels, not top-down control.
We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Because as communities go, so goes the nation.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Three Left Show. That was the first montage intro I've made out of five that I have. Anti-capitalist 101. I've explained why renewable energy isn't really that renewable, because it depends on fossil fuel infrastructure and a burning of a lot of energy. And it's just kind of assumed, falsely I believe, but this is usually the counter-argument that, look, we got to change our energy system, and if we have to burn some more fossil fuels to then have the ability to not burn fossil fuels, so be it. But as I pointed out, it still requires a lot of mining and extraction. We need to kind of get past extractive industries and the ability, the need that has to happen, or to have an extractive industry, if we do extraction, that it needs to be humane, respectful of the environment. And if that's the case, it's not going to be done in a profitable way. It can't be done for profit. It can't be done for an ever-increasing banking sector that needs perpetual growth. So now we get to a more deeper case for what I'm saying here. From foreign policy, from the debunker section, why growth can't be green. New data proves you can support capitalism or the environment, but it's really hard to do both. This is written by Jason Hickel, written on September 12th of last year. Warnings about ecological breakdown have become ubiquitous. Over the past few years, major newspapers, including The Guardian and The New York Times, have carried alarming stories on soil depletion, deforestation, and the collapse of fish stocks and insect populations. These crises have been driven by global economic growth and its accompanying consumption, which is destroying the Earth's biosphere bit by bit and blowing past key planetary boundaries that scientists say must be respected to avoid triggering collapse. Many policymakers have responded by pushing for what is called green growth, or a Green New Deal. All we need to do, they argue, is invest in more efficient technology and introduce the right incentives, and we'll be able to keep growing while simultaneously reducing our impact on the natural world, which is already at an unsustainable level. In technical terms, the goal is to achieve absolute decoupling of GDP from the total use of resources, according to a UN definition. It sounds like an elegant solution to an otherwise catastrophic problem, but there is one hitch. New evidence suggests that green growth isn't the panacea, the cure everyone has been hoping for. In fact, it isn't even possible. Huh? Green growth first became a buzz phrase at 2012 at the UN Conference on Sustainable Development in Rio. In the run-up to the conference, the World Bank, an organization, another global governance organizations, produced a report promoting green growth. Today, it is a core plank of UN Sustainable Development Goals. But the promise of green growth turns out to be based more on wishful thinking than on evidence. In the years since the Rio conference, three major empirical studies have arrived at some rather troubling conclusions. Even under the best conditions, absolute decoupling of GDP, which is, you know, the amount of value that our economy creates, from resource use is not possible on a global scale. team of scientists led by the German researcher Monika Dindrich first raised doubts in 2012. The group ran a sophisticated computer model that predicted what would happen to global resource use if economic growth continued on its current trajectory, increasing about 2-3% a year. It found that human consumption of natural resources, and that includes fish, livestock, forest, metals, fossil fuels, would rise from 70 billion metric tons to 180 billion by 2050. For reference, a sustainable level of resource use is 50 billion a year, a boundary that was breached back in 2000. The team then reran the model to see what would happen if every nation on Earth immediately adopted the best practice of efficient resource use, a very optimistic assumption. The results improved. Resource consumption would hit only 93 billion metric tons by 2050. But that is still a lot more than what we're consuming today. Burning through all those resources could hardly be described as absolute decoupling or green growth. So I'm going to repeat again. Sustainable resource use is globally 50 billion tons. We're at 70 billion back in 2012. We're probably at like 75 now. And but even if we're like totally efficient, you know, we increase efficiency, we still have to be using more, almost double, than was sustainable. Which is why it's said that if the rest of the world is to live like America or have American living standards as far as how much power we use and how much corn we eat and meat and eat, particularly meat, then we need two Earths. So that's what's meant by that. In 2016, a second team of scientists tested a different premise, one in which the world's nations all agreed to go above and beyond existing practice. In a best-case scenario, the researchers assumed a tax that would raise the global price of carbon from $50 currently to $236 per metric ton, and imagined technological innovations that would double efficiency. The results were almost the same as Dindrich's study. Under these conditions, if global economy kept growing by 3%, we'd still hit above 95 billion metric tons. Bottom line, there's no decoupling. So even with carbon taxes, you know, not just cap and trade, which is an absolute failure, but carbon taxes, you know, the better policy that you'll see social Democrats, Berniecrats fighting for. It's as long as the economy still grows, we're like cancer. And I mean that in a literal sense. Like, a cell division is sustainable when it's a certain rate. As soon as it has to continue, when cells continuously have to keep growing at a certain rate, it's cancer. And to put a kind of normal biological spin on this, to put it down to the individual scale, there's a certain age where you stop growing, right? Usually after puberty, maybe sometimes a little bit more in your teen years. You hit an age, you stop growing. You plateau. All life eventually plateaus. You stop growing. When you keep growing is usually something is immediately terribly wrong. That's cancer. But also, if, like, say your body kept growing. Can you imagine growing 3% until your entire life? It doesn't exist, right? Sounds like a crazy example, but it's the one that the kind of No Growth Institute, which is a educational little group, affinity group almost, with a fancy name in the website. And they advocate, you know, for this, that we need to stop growing, that we've grown enough. We have all this infrastructure, all this wealth that America has. We just need to use it properly. We don't need to create a bigger pie anymore. The pie is big enough, so to speak. Finally, last year, the UN Environment Program, once one of the main cheerleaders of green growth theory, weighed in. It tested the scenario of carbon priced at a whopping $570 per ton, slapped on a resource extraction tax, assumed rapid technological innovation spurred by a strong government support. What was the result? We hit 130 billion tons by 2050. This finding is worse than those of the two previous studies because, as the researchers accounted for, the rebound effect, whereby improvements in resource efficiency drive down prices and then cause demand to rise, canceling gains out entirely. This kind of reminds me of a certain example used in terms of like more efficient vacuums and more efficient appliances and things. You know, housework used to take 6 hours of the day, a whole day of housework. You need to do it every day. But with all of these electronic devices, labor-saving devices in your kitchen and your vacuum, you now have all this free time. But, I mean, it's a more fanciful example, but, okay, what does this housewife do with her free time then? More cleaning. You just end up vacuuming more often. And thus, maybe, you know, things are even cleaner than before, but the point is, you're kind of not really saving time. Much like, say, in the labor sector, we have all these efficiencies from computers and having a digital economy, and yet, we're all working more hours than ever before, and we're thus making less, right? The efficiencies of computers and automation hasn't led to a betterment of our actual living standards, but this is because all that created wealth and efficiency has gone to the top. As if we have green growth, that will not change. That will not change. We got to take the legs out of the whole thing. And maybe that comes in the form of taxing millionaires at 100% after the first $1 million, making an effective maximum income, you know, or taxing wealth at such a degree that resource hoarding and there's really no incentive to actually make as much profit as possible anymore because it's all going to go back to the public pot and be spent on, you know, universal basic income or whatever. So no one really has to work. But people will actually work because they actually want to at things they're actually good at things they actually want to do, be motivated, and you never have to deal with someone who is burned out, which is a lot of those quality of life issues that people gripe about, which are real. They're real problems, quality of life issues, you know, locally, a crossing guard who's phoning it in for the kids, or someone at your grocery store who just seems too tired and or doesn't seem to care and isn't attentive to you as you'd like. You know, it's all because we're all kind of, you know, prisoners of all this. There's a few more minutes left of this. Study after study shows the same thing. Scientists are beginning to realize that there is a physical limit to how effectively we can use resources. Thus, certain proclamations from scientists and statements saying, look, we need a full revolution of the economic system or it's complete collapse. There's no other options, political or otherwise. Like, need to move out away from capitalism. And that's really cool that we have all these new anti-capitalist scientists. I think they need to brand a little better because I think they're not proposing what kind of economic system we should shift to. They could do some reading and help out with that. But, I mean, that's what leftists like me are about. I've done that reading and what kind of economic system we could shift to. So. Oh yeah, I like this one because it kind of puts lifestylists on the defensive here. Scientists are beginning to realize that there are physical limits to how effectively we can use resources. Sure, we might be able to produce cars and iPhones and skyscrapers more efficiently, but we can't produce them out of thin air. We might shift the economy to services such as education and yoga, but even universities and workout studios require material input. Once we reach the limits of efficiency, pursuing any degree of growth drives resource use back up. Problems throw the entire concept of green growth into doubt and necessitate some radical rethinking. Remember that each of the three studies used highly optimistic assumptions. We are nowhere near imposing a global carbon tax, much less one of the nearly $600 per metric ton, and resource efficiency is only getting worse, not better. Yet the study suggested even if we do everything right, decoupling economic growth of resource use will remain elusive, and our environmental problems will continue to get worse. Providing the outcome will require a whole new paradigm. High taxes and technological innovation will help, but it's not going to be enough. The only realistic shot humanity has to averting ecological collapse, and that means all of our lives as well, and the lives of our grandchildren and humanity, is to impose hard caps on resource use. Hard caps. Such caps, enforced by national governments or by international treaty, could ensure that we do not extract more from the land and the sea than we can safely regenerate, that Earth can regenerate. We could also ditch GDP as an indicator of economic success and adapt a more balanced measure of genuine progress, which accounts for pollution and national and natural asset depletion, the use of stuff. Using GIP, as it's called, would help us maximize socially good outcomes and minimize bad ones. So there's no escaping an obvious conclusion. Ultimately, bringing our civilization back within a planetary boundary is going to require that we liberate ourselves from our dependence on growth. And that starts with rich nations like the U.S. This might sound scarier than it really is, though. Any growth doesn't mean shutting down economic activity. It simply means that next year, we can't produce or consume more than we are doing this year. We can't continue the pyramid scheme, right? Where if you're in a multi-level marketing thing, you have to continuously recruit new people, right? With no consideration for market saturation. And this is something all companies have a problem with. They just assume, like, I mean, maybe they actually think about market saturation. And it's like, okay, we can't really expand anymore. We've maxed out our customer base. And as such, we've maxed out the customer base, meaning of the planet, of what we can take out. We did that in 2000. Ending growth doesn't mean that living standards need to take a hit, though. Our planet provides more than enough. The problem is that our resources are not equally distributed. Inequality. We can improve people's lives right now by simply sharing what we already have. So I already said that, and that's the end of the article. I'm going to move on. So I'm going to shift topics, so to speak. I mean, obviously, it's still one meta topic of how terrible markets are, I suppose, as one of my intros kind of pointed out, made the statement. But it's a completely different tack. Not going to talk about environmental issues anymore. I'm going to shift toward digital economy, online streaming and whatnot. So with two stories, hopefully I can get through them. I'm going to this piece from The Verge, which is kind of a tech and science site. And this is a long-form article. Actual journalism here. It's a feature piece called Science's Pirate Queen. Alexandria Ibanka is plundering the academic publishing establishment. So this is about how... So I'm just going to go through some key concepts that when it comes to science journals, right, the innovation in science, technology, and so on depends on a free access of ideas. Everyone's good idea is based on five other people's good ideas. You know, you can't make good decisions without access to information. And this is something many firms know. It's what copyright is all about. I'm anti-copyright. Most leftists are anti-copyright. I think the best you can kind of get a liberal is, okay, maybe copyright for a few years, maybe five. But there still needs to be copyright. You know, what driver is there for someone to innovate if they can't profit from it? Well, therein lies, you just stated the problem. Someone has to profit off of a good idea with a monetary profit, right? Monetary reward. But of course, you know, if you have a great idea, there's social rewards. People will give you stuff. It's not like there's no lack of incentive for doing good deeds. Sometimes they're their own reward. I had this pseudo argument with someone with totally individualistic mindset, where he was saying, like, well, when you give food to a homeless person, you're really doing it for yourself to feel better. I'm like, yeah, but then the homeless person also feels better. Everybody wins. I feel good. They feel good. Everyone wins. Believe it or not, you can say it's the selfish thing to give to others and share. So the selfish thing is also the altruistic thing. And the altruistic thing is also the selfish thing. So it's almost like there's a unity of opposites. It's all the same thing. It's a false division to say that. But there is selfish activity that is not altruistic. So to get through that, key point of the Pirate Queen. So the paywalls for science papers, there's an oligarchy of five big companies. It's totally exploitative. Sometimes you're kind of scientists. Sometimes there's a paying twice. Research is done via public money, but then scientists publish their work via these publishing outlets, and then they and the public then have to, and the colleges and the universities then have to pay the publishers for said research. So the public, all of it, is paying twice. That sounds like efficiency to me. So another key point, there's an open access movement that's been around for quite a while, as long as the internet's been around, which kind of believes in open access, the free access to, and it's defined as a free access to things on a public web. An example, there are public libraries of science. There's MIT has all of their coursework online. There's many institutions that do some of this. But there is a split. There's legal open access, which is where people legally share things online. And then there's the illegal open access, which is there are companies that claim this is their property, this information, but information wants to be free. I'm going to liberate it, aka pirate it. Now, as long as we're in a capitalist economy, people need to make their daily bread, and that includes publishers. The article goes into how publishers do, in fact, create value for scientific papers. For example, The Verge and other such science blogs will cover things based on press releases put out by publishers. They write them, they peer review, they edit, and they do all kinds of things, value-added services. But sometimes it gets a little dicey when Nature, a science journal, major one, says that the cost of putting out one paper for them is $30,000. What? And thus, like, you know, they have to put up massive paywalls. And it's costing universities millions of dollars, and it's unsustainable as far as saturation. You know, you have five companies, they can charge whatever they want. But universities have to actually forego some of this because it gets too expensive. Or they do pay these things, and then they have to up tuition, thus driving university the tuition costs up, which then get passed to debt-ridden students. Oh yeah, some open access journals, but only about 30%, do charge fees to scientists. That way, the papers are free and publicly available. The cost is then put on the scientists, so there's a push to, when research is funded, that, you know, like the grants, that the cost of publishing is included in it. Because just as important as funding science is funding the ability for people to use it. Something that private research and development doesn't put any money in, doesn't have to, because they're not about sharing their discoveries, which thus creates the need. It creates opacity, lack of transparency, and thus creates the need for conspiracy theories, or at least it creates speculation about these private companies could have the cure for cancer or certain types of cancer, but it's not to their advantage to release that information, the research available for other people to use, even if they're not going to use it to create a drug that would, you know, solve a problem. And that's all because it's profit-driven, you know, whether it sounds crazy and irrational or not. It's actually reasonable to make these assumptions. Now, in order to counter public sharing, the legal kind even, a lot of these big publishers, not only through lawsuits of pirates and other people, they put pressure on scientists with these educational initiatives. They've shifted. Oh, yeah. And of course, over the years, they've lobbied the federal government, all kinds of federal policy that clamps down on public sharing and pirating and all that stuff, particularly pressure on ISPs, the providers of internet access. And then shifting to stop scientists from sharing with kind of their own little side of how to share. Learn, you know, click on, you know, and giving little packets to all the scientists of how to responsibly share your work. basically limiting it to peer groups of scientists or within a university, don't share with people outside, because there'll be tons of people who simply, and this is how public databases are created in the first place, is just asking the scientists, hey, can I have your work? I'm going to put it on a public database. And they're like, sure, I believe in free, I'm a liberal professor. But as these companies, these big five publishers, continue to choke out and fight piracy and even legal open access, or rather, by choking and trying to prevent legal open access, they are encouraging illegal open access. And this is kind of like the libertarian right-wing case that more regulation creates black markets. Now, in the case of open access stuff, though, of course, it's not really a black market because no one's actually profiting from it. Now, this pirate queen, who's a Russian student who's created Science Hub, Sci-Hub, which is one of the largest, basically, sources for pirated science papers. She takes donations and things, but that's just for her own income and to keep things going. Not exactly the next billionaire, okay? Even though, like, say, the publisher market, one of them with their parent company, it has a cap of $35 billion. Now, this is a long article. I'm not actually going to read any of it. I want to read one part, though, because the pirate queen herself has communist leanings. In fact, kind of scientific communism, just as a communism of science, that all science is produced for the public good and thus needs to be shared for the public good. And sharing is caring. And if you share with someone or have the prediction of if you're, say, having lunch with someone and someone has nothing to eat and you just share a little bit of your lunch, if you have the nerve, the capacity of doing that, hey, you're part communist. Everyone has that instinct. It's a social human instinct. And it's just as natural as the instinct to hoard resources, act in one's self-interest. There's human nature is more than one thing. And if you're a moderate, then you think about how can we balance these two instincts and have both, you know, socialism and capitalism work together. Now, I've made the case that we can't really have capitalism at all if we're going to survive, period. So I'm solid lefty, and that's the case I make to people who, even though super reasonable moderates, actual moderates who actually do want, like, socialist policy with, but still have for-profit banks and people the ability to be as rich as possible. You know, like that's some kind of moral imperative, the freedom to be a billionaire or even a millionaire. But there is no ethical millionaire. Something was stolen. Sorry for my lack of good vamping. One of my other key component here was, so the legal open access movement kind of calls illegal pirating, you know, it's giving us a bad name. And they want to draw a distinction. And this is kind of the distinction between reform politics versus radical politics. Reform politics thinks it's good enough to have legal open access journals. But they are under market pressures. And pressures from the corporate sector. When you're pirating, then you're pressured by corporations that then use the state and state violence to shut you down. That's very interesting. And if we did have a socialist economy where resources are distributed in a fair, egalitarian manner, that includes, you know, two private enterprises, it's not like you're eliminating any of that. But it takes out all of these pressures to conform to exploitative practice, the need to exploit others. Get rid of the pyramid scheme by creating an economy that is flat, or as flat as possible. And if not socially flat, then it becomes like a conversation about social capital, which is kind of the new thing, that neoliberalism creates a market everywhere and wants to commodify everything to make having social capital, you know, having more friends, profitable. And that's ugly. It's ugly. And it's creating basically like the new way of making wealth for yourself is you can't do it with housing, you can't do it with your social skills or whatever. So a similar story is not about science papers, but something maybe we all interact with, or at least a lot of us do. And it is about live streaming services, particularly media. The rise of Netflix competitors have pushed consumers back towards piracy. So in the same vein of scientists being pushed into pirating their, or illegally sharing, you know, if you make sharing illegal, then any sharing you do is then illegal and a crime. Kind of throws the whole justice system into doubt, doesn't it? BitTorrent usage has bounced back because there's too many streaming services and too much exclusive, aka copyrighted, content. A new study shows, and this is a short one, shows that after years of decline, BitTorrent usage and piracy is on the rise again. The culprit? An increase in exclusivity deals that force subscribers to hunt and peck among a myriad of streaming services and finally find the content that they're looking for. We've been a few years on since the rise of Netflix and Hulu, which was its main competitor. And it's kind of a good argument for centralization, economically speaking, that you know you have one place with most, if not all the content. But it had a lot of content, a lot of resources, as it were, media resources. And so it was efficient that you just pay the one subscription and then you have access to it. So for those that can pay it, it wasn't very expensive. It's still $8 or so a month. As other companies who, you know, had given and made deals with Netflix to sign their content saw the success that Netflix had and they want a piece of it, thinking that market saturation isn't a thing, that people will go to their exclusive, you know, get their exclusive content. But they're thinking like corporate execs, and then their mindset is so they know exactly, oh, they know just how things work, don't they? So Sandvine's new Global Internet Phenomena report offers some interesting insight into user video habits and the internet, such as the fact that more than 50% of internet traffic is now encrypted. Video now accounts for 58% of all global traffic, and Netflix alone comprises 15% of all internet downstream data consumed. But there's another interesting tidbit. After this year's steady decline, BitTorrent usage was once again growing. BitTorrent is how one pirates content. According to Sandvine, file sharing accounts for 3% of global downstream and 22% of upstream traffic, with 97% of that traffic being BitTorrent. While BitTorrent is often used to distribute ordinary files, it remains the choice du jour for those looking to distribute and trade copyrighted content online, made easier via media PCs running Kodi or select plugins. Back in 2011, Sandvine stated that BitTorrent accounted for half of upstream traffic on fixed broadband networks in North America. By 2015, its share had dipped to roughly 30%, largely thanks to a rise in quality, inexpensive streaming, which created an alternative to piracy. So a centralized access that's efficient reduced quote-unquote crime. I point that out. Throw that out there. That interpretation. But Sandvine noted this trend was now reversing slightly, with BitTorrent's traffic share once again growing worldwide, especially in the Middle East, Europe, and Africa, where BitTorrent now accounts for a third of all upstream traffic. One major reason for its popularity? Annoyingly, exclusivity deals in streaming. Quote, more sources are approaching exclusive content available on a single streaming broadcast service. Think Game of Thrones for HBO, House of Cards for Netflix, Handmaid's Tale for Hulu, and Jack Ryan for Amazon. Disney, CBS, and all the other major networks are also creating their own streaming services. To get access to all of these can get very expensive to a consumer, so they subscribe to one or two and pirate the rest. As more and more companies jump into the streaming race, they're cordoning off must-have content into wider and wider array of exclusivity silos, as all companies do with their copyrights. Disney, for example, will soon be pulling most of its fare from Netflix as it launches its own streaming service this year. Studies have shown that nearly all major broadcasters will have launched their own streaming service by 2022, and these companies are increasingly choosing to keep their own content as in-house exclusives to drive up subscriptions. On one hand, that makes sense. Numerous streaming providers are now winning awards for their original, usually exclusive content. TV's dead, people. TV's dead. The better, more exclusive your content is, the more subscribers you can drive to your service. But the problem, consumers only have so much disposable income. Much like the planet has only so much resources that we can extract from it before we kill everything. And the growing laundry list of services users now need to subscribe to if they want to watch all of their favorite movies and shows can not only be confusing, but prohibitively expensive. That's especially true overseas, where geographical viewing is restricted. As a result, these users are starting to drift back to piracy. Keep in mind that BitTorrent usage numbers are likely higher than Sandvine estimates, given the high numbers of users that hide their traffic behind proxies, VPNs, which are things screen, and not only dodge the prying eyes of ISPs, but avoid copyright trolls and industry lawsuits. Content industry spent years trying to battle piracy via all manner of heavy-handed tactics, only realized that offering users inexpensive, quality, legitimate services was the best solution. Many users flocked to these services because they provided a less expensive and more flexible alternative than traditional cable. Now, if the industry isn't careful, it could lose a sizable chunk of this newfound audience. And this is what happened with cable, in my eyes, personally, that you have more and more channels that are more and more specified and have less and less original content being created, as it just things get stretched out, where you have like a cable channel that's just like four programs on repeat. So it's like, that's not worth it. And yeah, so as you just had this proliferation, and it just became too much to watch, right? You know, 400 channels, nothing to watch. And basically that's, as markets tend to do, it's repeating the same pattern. Now we're going to have dozens of streaming services and very little to watch. Unless, of course, you pirate. So that's something to go on. And then, oh, by the way, this is from Motherboard, subdivision of Vice, also a subdivision of an even larger corporate media conglomerate. But hey, they actually cover like piracy as a subtopic, because it is very much a part of the internet. Okay, so that ends all of my scripted articles. And in the last few bits, and I'm going to stop early, play some music. I have to get out of here because we have a storm coming here in the Northeast. But I want to go on. I promised I would talk about my current viewing of Netflix, which is, if you recall the show from the 90s, I'm a 90s kid, Carmen Sandiego. We don't have a lot of geography-related game shows. It was a game show originally, and then it was kind of an educational cartoon with little bits of geography in there. Now Netflix has created a reboot of Carmen Sandiego, one where she's in fact the protagonist. Why? Because she's a Robin Hood type. She steals from other thieves, white-collar criminals, and a criminal syndicate, which she grew up in. That's her backstory. Won't get into that. But what I will get into is some of the themes of it, which is something that stealing isn't just artifacts and treasures, but there's a theming of stealing lives, something she didn't want to do, and thus she spooked out and became an antagonist to the criminal underworld. And stealing history, that you're not just stealing a piece of gold or art, you're stealing history from people. You're stealing culture, you're stealing identity from people. That very interesting writing there. It is well written. And if you recall the Esurance commercials with the animated character there, it looks like that. It looks like if Esurance wasn't just an ad. And at the beginning of every episode, there's still a little like geography tidbit, so it still has that educational character, but it's just kind of put in the beginning. where they're kind of talking about where they are. And it's like, hey, did you know this about Ecuador? So it's a lot of fun. And I'm going to be watching all of it, I suppose. And I also want to point out that Carmen Sandiego is the ultimate cosmopolitan character in this show, where, you know, because she grew up in this isolated criminal syndicate that's global, she's like, oh, I was raised by all people from very different cultures and I learned all the different languages. And so she's the ultimate global citizen, not only just a globetrotter as a tourist with Zach and Ivy characters from previous incarnations of the show, but now they're partners and they all have Boston accents, which is, I can't tell you how hilarious it is sometimes because of a inside joke I have about, because sometimes it's like a Brooklyn accent, but it's a Boston accent. Sometimes it kind of goes back and forth. That's what's funny about it. But she's the ultimate cosmopolitan person, and the antidote to capitalist global domination, that where, you know, globalism, the globalist Jewish banking conspiracy, all that right-wing claptrap, the antidote is a social cosmopolitan ethic that I don't have to care about someone in India as much as my neighbor or a family member particularly, but I can at least have enough wherewithal to recognize them as a fellow human with similar values, but certainly having the right to their own identity, history, material culture, and access to resources, as is my definition of socialism, equal access to commonly held resources. And that is natural resources. It's all common. It only belongs to certain people because of constructs, individual lines, and pieces of paper that are reinforced by our support for it. Support for capitalism. Supporting the federal government, currently in shutdown mode, but really it's just the social parts of it that are shut down. Security state's still up. Military state's still up. Police are still up, of course. Can't actually leave our system actually vulnerable to the marginal. And so she's a, you know, this is a marginal person, Carmen Sandiego, who is using her skills for good. Like, in previous incarnations of Carmen Sandiego, because it was formerly a game show, there'd be a player. And you, the viewer, are the player playing the game, or a board game, or whatever, of Carmen Sandiego. In this case, there's still a player, but this case, player is an actual character who's a white hat hacker, which is a real term, I know. A white hat hacker is a hacker who uses their skills for good, doing Robin Hood type things, if they actually do steal from corporations or not, but usually takes the form of doxing Nazis. Yeah, like stealing the information of people who are suspected Nazis to figure out if they really are organizing white supremacy, and exposing that, or exposing other types of corruption, because corruption is usually hidden and you actually have to break a law or two to actually find injustice in the world, because corporate power and state have put up many barriers to information, to between us and the ability to self-govern, the ability to choose our own destinies. And that's capitalism for you. And that is why I am against it. And I'd like alternatives in the future. And there will be other episodes that I do to talk about that stuff. But lately I've been on a kick of describing problem. And that's fine, because that's just the beginning of the year blues, I guess. But we'll get there. Especially as I have other guests on talk about things. And so that's just a matter of just doing it and getting things sorted. So thank you very much for joining me on the show. I'm going to wrap up housekeeping, which is to talk about how I have a Patreon. I have one donor, the second fulfillment, they're called. So that's my one patron. And go to patreon.com, three lefts, to materially support the show. You can socially support the show by sharing it in any and all possible ways. Word of mouth is actually best. people, if you trust you, trust your opinion, like, oh, hey, this podcast is cool. This guy is Cat, Dan Platt. Of course, on social media, I have a Facebook page and a Twitter account. Though now that I'm kind of like looking at Twitter again, I'm realizing how much I don't like Twitter. The information that's shared on it is just so limiting. And at the very least, if you go to the Twitter page, Three Lefts at Twitter, I'll be sharing the episodes there. As you can also access the episodes via any podcast app that you have on desktop, on smartphone, or where have you, or tablet. If you have a tablet, I'm never going to have a tablet. So stay radical, stay thinking, stay open to new ideas. Hopefully this will expand your point of view a tiny bit, as I try to grow personally and such. So thank you very much if you're listening live, but if you're not, that's excellent too. Not question mark. Thank you very much. This has been Three Left Show. I've been your host, Dan Platt, live from WCAA Community Radio here in Albany, New York.